Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. We've come a long way. Treating kids with cancer 50 years ago was almost a joke. There was little chance of survival, and the side effects were sometimes worse than the disease itself. Today, 8 out of 10 kids with cancer will survive. Behind that statistic, there are consequences of treatment. The hair and weight loss, the months and sometimes years of missed school, the higher risks of secondary cancer. What if we could laser in on the problem-causing cells, eliminate them, and leave the rest of the body unharmed? Teach our bodies to use our own immune systems to fight off cancer. This is perhaps the next phase in cancer care. My guest today is Dr. Ted Leitch, an assistant professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center. He researches novel therapeutics for childhood cancer. Welcome to Think, Ted.
Thank you.
So let's, before we talk about immunotherapy, let's talk about chemotherapy, something we're all at least familiar with the term. How does chemotherapy work?
So chemotherapy was essentially the first treatment for cancer that was developed. And chemotherapy works by going into the body and damaging the DNA in all the cells in your body. What happens is that cancer cells are more susceptible to that damage, and so in that sense, it specifically kills the cancer cells. But it's actually not very specific at all. It damages all the cells in your body, and that's why it causes all the side effects that you just described, like the hair loss or heart damage or risk for second cancers in the future.
So there are serious, those are the side effects and those are the consequences of sticking with chemotherapy.
Those are absolutely the consequences of sticking with chemotherapy.
But it's been the best possible available.
It has, and we've made great strides with chemotherapy. As you described, you know, 50 years ago, every child with leukemia died within a few months, and now the vast majority of children with leukemia are cured, and many other tumors have followed. So chemotherapy has definitely revolutionized the care of cancer, but it comes with many side effects, and we're also reaching a plateau where we haven't been able to make as much progress recently in terms of improving outcomes by changing around chemotherapies as we had in the past.
So gains, I've seen this statistic or numbers that really we've made these huge strides, but in the past decade or so, the numbers of survival increase hasn't been that great.
It hasn't changed that much in the last decade. I think we're reaching the limit of what we're able to do with chemotherapy, and we need to think about new ways to try to treat cancer and target specifically cancer cells in a different way than this more sort of non-specific chemotherapy that we've been using.
How different are cancer cells from the rest of the cells that are in our body?
So cancer cells come from the rest of the cells in your body. We've learned that cancer cells are caused by changes in the DNA, mutations in the DNA in the cell. So the DNA is the genes that you get from your mother and your father. Every cell in your body has all those instructions on how to make your whole body. What happens in a cancer cell is that there are changes in that DNA that cause the cell to grow uncontrollably and not be able to stop. So they're derived from your own body. And so from that standpoint, it can be tricky to try to find things that specifically target the cancer without causing side effects and damaging the rest of your body.
Now, one thing that's been a buzzword in research lately has been immunotherapy. What is immunotherapy exactly?
So we've learned that many of us develop cells that could become cancer many times in our lives, and our immune system actually seeks out and kills those cells before we ever know they're there.
So I could have some cancer cells in my body.
You could have some cancer cells right now, and most often your immune system will go out and attack those cells and kill those cells, and you'll never know it. It'll never cause you any problem. But we've also learned that cancer cells have been able to escape the immune system, so that's why they're able to grow to the point that they start causing symptoms and that doctors are able to diagnose the cancer. So immunotherapy is really trying to turn your body's immune system back on so that it recognizes those cancer cells and attacks and kills those cancer cells.
I've heard an analogy where it's sort of like the cancer cells almost have camouflage, or the immune cells can't see the cancer, and it's like lifting a veil that's over their eyes to try and attack that.
Right. One of the things that we know happens when cancer develops is that those cells become more and more invisible to the immune system. They express proteins on their surface to make them so that the immune system sort of can't see, sort of like camouflage proteins, as you mentioned, that hides the cancer cells from the immune system so that when the immune system comes around and should kill it, it's not able to do that. And immunotherapy works in several different ways, but one of the ways is trying to turn off those proteins that shut down the immune response to your cancer.
Who came up with the idea of immunotherapy? How far back does this go?
So the idea of immunotherapy has actually gone back about 50 years, about as long as we've been treating cancer. But we didn't really understand enough about the immune system or about cancer in the past to really be able to harness its potential. And so it's only been within the last 5 to 10 years that we've really seen the great promise of immunotherapy for cancer.
What right now is the most promising research that's been done on immunotherapy? Give me sort of an example of something that's been developed.
I think there's two really, really good examples. One of them is for adults with melanoma. There has been several
groups. That's a skin cancer.
Sorry, yes. So melanoma is a skin cancer, one of the cancers that we get from being outside in the sun too much and not wearing our sunscreen. Melanoma, because it's caused by damage from the sun, has lots of different mutations and changes in the DNA and the genes. And one of the treatments that has been applied very successfully recently is using antibodies that turn back on the immune system, that cover up that veil that the cells have to hide from the immune system. And for the first time, adults with metastatic melanoma, so melanoma that's spread throughout the body, some number of those adults are able to be what looks like cured from that therapy, or at least are long-term survivors 10 years out without any cancer, which is something we've never seen before.
So how does that drug work? Are you giving the person an IV bag that has antibodies in it, or how are you changing and perhaps lifting the veil on their own immune cells?
So for that treatment, we're actually giving, exactly as you described, an IV bag that has an antibody that essentially covers up that camouflage protein on the cells so that then the immune system is not turned off by the cell. So we're hiding that. The camouflage, essentially, double camouflaging the camouflage to make the cancer cells
highlighting the camouflage, perhaps.
Another example of a different immunotherapy is CART therapy for pediatric patients with leukemia. So CART therapy is different in that we're not actually turning the immune system on itself, but we take the immune cells out of the patient, we infect them with a virus, and the virus causes them to express a receptor for the cancer on their surface. And then we give those cells back to the patient, and then they circulate in the patient's body, attacking the cancer cells.
I'm going to make you walk me through that one more time. That's fascinating. So the first one you talked about for melanoma is really helping what's already in the person, the immune cells in the person, to recognize something that had been hidden before.
Correct.
And the second one that you're talking about, this CART therapy, is actually taking out those immune cells, almost training them in a sense,
right,
and putting them back in.
Exactly. So we train them by infecting them with a virus that has a receptor that has an antibody essentially on the surface of the cells. They're special cells called T cells, which are the cells that attack cancers in your body. And we train them and we grow them in the lab so that they're expanded and ready to attack the cancer cells. And then we infuse them back into the patient. And there they go throughout the body finding the cancer cells and killing the cancer cells.
When you infuse those back into the patient, do you ever have a problem with those cells seeming different than what's already in the patient? You know, that the idea of the body saying, wait a second, are those still my same cells?
So it's possible for the body to reject them, although we really haven't seen that. The side effect that we've seen more often is actually that they cause so much inflammation from attacking the cancer cells that patients can get very sick when we give them back.
So they're sort of like rabid dogs or something. I mean, they're going in and they know what they're after.
They are. They essentially train the immune system to think that your cancer is an infection. So if you imagine having someone with leukemia, the leukemia is spread throughout their body, and their body all of a sudden discovers that they have this, what seems like an infection, spread throughout their body. And so they can get very sick with the same symptoms you might see with a very severe infection, like high fevers and low blood pressure and breathing problems.
And what do you do for that side effect? I imagine that's a pretty big concern for kids.
So it is. We have to watch those kids very, very carefully. They're kept nearby the hospital or in the hospital to observe for that side effect. And then we actually give them drugs to turn down their immune system a little bit to try to keep it high enough that it still attacks the cancer cells, but not so high that they get so sick.
Now, when KERA did its series last month, Growing Up After Cancer, I profiled a boy in Plano, Jude Kobler, and his family. And he was diagnosed at age 5 with leukemia, the type that this drug you're talking about acts on, acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And during the reporting, he had been about 5 years cancer-free. And just weeks ago, we learned that he actually relapsed. How much has treatment for kids like Jude with ALL changed? 5 years ago, would he have been able to try something like immunotherapy?
So immunotherapy has only been used for kids with ALL for about the past 2 to 3 years. So 5 years ago, this wouldn't have been an option for him.
Might it have been something that, and I know you're somewhat familiar with his case, that they would have tried if he had come down with ALL today?
Certainly, this is something that we're trying for kids who whose ALL comes back after treatment or doesn't respond to treatment. We want to know more about it before we give it to kids with the first time we treat their ALL. And that's really because, you know, the longest patient has been treated with this is about 3 years. And so we don't know the long-term effects of this therapy. And as we mentioned, most kids with ALL are cured with standard chemotherapy right now. So 80 to 90% of them are cured. But if his ALL came back in the same way that it was originally right now, this is absolutely something we would think about for him.
Interesting. So the longest that someone has been treated with this is a girl, and she was profiled in the documentary, The Emperor of All Maladies, right? That's the patient.
Yes. So she's 3 years out from her treatment right now.
And so far, so good?
So far, she's doing great.
So there's also something else that you're working on at UT Southwestern, another sort of breakthrough treatment for cancer that has to do with genetic sequencing.
So one of the other things we've learned about cancer is that it is caused by these changes, these mutations in the DNA of the cancer cells. And so over the last 20 years, we've learned more about the specific mutations that cause cancer. And one of the things that's become possible only within the last few years is actually taking cells from each patient who has cancer and sending those to a lab where they can sequence the DNA to try to find the changes, that the mutations that make that patient's cancer be a cancer cell and not a normal cell. And then we have, for some of those mutations, we have specific drugs that can target that mutation and try to turn it off, to try to specifically target the cancer rather than more generally treating with drugs that are not as smart like our traditional chemotherapy agents.
Now, has this research been revolutionized at all in a sense since we've been able to sequence our DNA so much cheaper and faster?
Absolutely. So, you know, it was the first person's DNA was sequenced in the early 2000s, and it cost about $1 billion and took about 10 years to complete.
Yes.
And now I can take DNA from one of my patients and for a few thousand dollars and in about 2 to 3 weeks get back the genetic sequence of their tumor. And so that revolution has really made this possible. It certainly wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago, 5 years ago.
So is that what they can do also when they're checking for who might be a bone marrow donor match or something? They're also looking at DNA.
They are, and that's one of the things that's helped us get better matches for bone marrow donors. So we used to just look at the proteins on the cell to try to find cells that matched, and we've learned more and more that there are subtle differences in the DNA from different people. And so we're able to more specifically sequence the DNA of the HLA genes, the genes that make you a match for a bone marrow donor, and get more information about who's going to be the best donor for a patient. Just from a cotton swab.
Inside your mouth. That's impressive. So we'll talk more about genetic sequencing. But right now we're talking with Dr. Ted Leitch. He's an assistant professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center here in Dallas, and he's researching novel therapeutics for childhood cancer, things like immunotherapy and genetic sequencing. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverman. And we'll be back with more from Ted Leitch after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
Certainly, treatments have changed and diagnoses and optimistic outlooks have changed dramatically since the 1970s when I went through this. Thankfully, they have. The radiation that I received, I've been told now, was way too much for a human body. I remember the radiation was so strong that under my arms, the skin literally turned black. It looked like charred meat. No one told me to expect that. It just happened, and I kept going.
That's Cindy Sakirki of Mansfield, and she had Hodgkin's lymphoma as a teenager. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. And we're talking today with Dr. Ted Leitch. He's an assistant professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center researching novel therapeutics for childhood cancer. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. Dr. Leitch, what role does radiation play in treatment for childhood cancer today?
So we still use radiation more than we'd like to, actually, for treatment of childhood cancer. One of the things we know is that radiation is one of those treatments that has lots of long-term side effects, and especially the risk for second cancers, and also the risk for damage to the brain in young children when they receive radiation that involves their brain. So we've been trying over the last 20 to 30 years to reduce the number of patients that require radiation, but still far more do than we would hope to have to treat that way.
So which cancers are, I guess, best treated by radiation? Where does it come in the most handy?
So we use it most often in solid tumors, so in patients who have a tumor that's not surgically resectable, or in some cases even when it is resectable, we know that we have to give radiation because there's tumor cells that have essentially snuck out of the tumor into the surrounding tissues. And so in those cases, those patients often require radiation. We also use it for leukemia and for patients that have leukemia that involves their brain, leukemia that we can detect in their spinal fluid. And for those patients, they also have to often get radiation that involves their brain, and that's where we worry a lot about the developmental side effects of the treatment.
Because it can be long-term, we're seeing some educational challenges and...
Right. So especially in younger children, the younger you are, the more we worry about the long-term developmental consequences. And in some children, when we first developed treatment for leukemia, we saw it come back a lot in the spinal fluid. And so the treatment became that those children would all get radiation to their brain. And many of those children now have very significant learning problems, and some of them aren't able to live on their own, for example. So it can be very severe.
Do we see those types of long-term effects from chemotherapy, or what long-term effects do we see?
We can. We worry about those effects from chemotherapy as well. The way we've treated leukemia is we've replaced radiation for most patients with chemotherapy that's actually given into the spinal fluid. And while it's definitely better than radiation, it still can have long-term effects on development and growth of the brain in children. We also see other effects, like we worry a lot about damage to the heart in growing children from some of our chemotherapy agents, so we watch carefully for that. We worry for some of our treatments about how children are able to grow and about the strength of their bones.
I heard one doctor when we were doing the Growing Up After Cancer series say that, of course, you're going to have some side effects because you are essentially, for kids treating with leukemia, bathing their brain in chemicals.
Exactly.
So that's hard. I mean, that's hard. That must be very hard for parents to even come to terms with, but I guess you have to do it.
We do. We learned very quickly in the treatment of childhood leukemia that the cancer cells can hide in the spinal fluid because our chemotherapy we give to the rest of the body doesn't get there very well.
It's sort of an isolated section.
It is. The brain is actually normally very protected because your body has evolved to not allow chemicals into there because it wants to protect it. And so we've learned that it does the same thing for chemotherapy, and we actually have to bathe the brain essentially in chemotherapy specifically.
Someone wrote in, David asks, in light of the terrible side effects of chemotherapy, why not go straight to immunotherapy or viral therapy?
So that's an excellent question. I think right now we don't yet know how effective those things are for the long term. So for the future, that's absolutely one of our goals, is to try to reduce the side effects and then reduce the amount of chemotherapy that we have to give patients so that they are able to have less long-term side effects. But as you said, we've also reached a point right now where many children are able to be cured with chemotherapy, and we certainly don't want to have children die that we could have otherwise cured. by trying an experimental therapy when it wasn't the right time.
Now, are these experimental therapies, I've heard the term targeted therapies for cancer. Is immunotherapy one of these targeted therapies?
So you can think about it that way. I think most people use the word targeted therapies to mean an inhibitor of a specific abnormal gene in a cancer cell. And so in that way, immunotherapy is different. But immunotherapy is actually absolutely turning the body on to a target. It's targeting the abnormal cell in the cancer itself.
But it's different, I guess, than the genetic sequencing, and those are really targeted therapies.
Right. So those are targeted therapies. An example of that is a medicine called imatinib. Mm-hmm. So this was sort of the first targeted therapy that was developed and revolutionized the care of people with a disease called CML, chronic myelocytic leukemia. And CML is a disease that used to require a bone marrow transplant to be cured. And this drug called imatinib specifically targets the abnormal gene in CML. And when it first came out, there was much, much excitement because almost all patients, when treated with this drug, had their CML get better. And many of them have been able to stay on this drug for many years without ever requiring a bone marrow transplant, which has many, many side effects.
Wow. Yes. I mean, to have a bone marrow transplant, you have to also do full body radiation. And there's quite a preparation that brings you.
Exactly. So many patients who get a bone marrow transplant have to get radiation. They all have to get high-dose chemotherapy. They all have a risk of having something called graft versus host disease, which is actually where the new bone marrow that's been given to them attacks their own body and can make you very sick. So this has revolutionized the care of CML.
Now, talk to me about how the idea of this drug, imatinib, is that sort of the term for it, goes from an idea to being an actual drug. What happens?
So it's based on lots of research in a laboratory. So laboratory scientists have worked very hard to figure out what genes cause cancer, right? Which mutations in a gene or in a cell cause that cell to turn cancerous. And in the case of CML, they found out that it was this chromosome called the Philadelphia chromosome, or a gene called BCR-ABL. And when cells were given this gene, they turned into this type of leukemia. And so then they go looking, testing many different drugs and many different compounds to try to find a compound that specifically targets and turns off that gene. And in this case, they were able to do that and then tried that in a laboratory and then in patients in clinical trials. And then when those are successful, then that medicine becomes FDA approved.
So how long was that process? I can't imagine it would happen overnight.
So that process was quite long. It was probably 20 years for that drug. We're trying very hard to speed up that process. And there have been a few examples where more recently that's been quicker. So a different gene mutation called ALK was recently discovered in lung cancer and in children, actually, with a cancer called neuroblastoma, which is a cancer that often happens in the stomach or the abdomen of young children. And these mutations in this gene called ALK were discovered in the mid-2000s, and there's already now an approved medication to treat those. So that process is accelerating, but it's still slower than any of us want.
What are the roadblocks in getting that process to move a little bit faster? I imagine it's not just ideas, but funding and...
Absolutely. Funding is a major portion of this. This requires a lot of laboratory study to identify the mutations and to try different drugs and different compounds and figure out the one that's best and then the one that will be best tolerated by the patient and have the fewest side effects. And then it actually requires clinical trials to evaluate that drug in patients to make sure that it works and make sure that it's safe. And recently, actually, we've been suffering a lot of cutbacks in funding from the NIH, whose budget has been cut.
From the National Institute of Health.
Sorry, yes,
They provide the majority of funding for
cancer research, and in the last 5 to 10 years, their budget's been cut about 25%. And so it's making it more and more difficult to make these discoveries.
So which are you working on right now in the lab? What's going on at UT Southwestern?
So we're studying a number of different diseases. We're studying a disease called rhabdomyosarcoma, which is a particular type of sarcoma that happens in young children, and trying to find new ways to combine targeted therapy with chemotherapy to try to cure patients. And then we're also studying some new ways to give chemotherapy to try to make it more localized just to your tumor, something that we're trying to do using heating of the tumor There's other ways to do it, but we're trying to look at, can we deliver the chemotherapy just to the tumor so that we spare the side effects on the rest of the body?
Because right now for chemotherapy, how is it delivered? Through a port in the body?
So most often it's delivered through a port, so intravenously, just through the blood that goes everywhere in the body. Sometimes we also deliver it by mouth or, as I mentioned, through the spinal fluid. But chemotherapy right now goes to every cell in your body. And our goal is to really be able to target that just to the cancer cells.
Let's go to Lisa in Fort Worth. She is calling about someone in her family. Lisa, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. What's your question?
My 13-year-old nephew was recently diagnosed with a benign brain tumor, and I was wondering that one of the possibilities to get the last 5% of the tumor is chemotherapy. And I was wondering, what risk does that put him for later in life of getting cancer?
Great question.
Because the tumor right now is benign.
So that's an excellent question. And it depends on the specific chemotherapy that the doctor might recommend. Some chemotherapy agents do have a risk of causing cancer later on in life, but it depends on the specific treatment that your doctor would recommend.
Is brain cancer a very different type of cancer to treat in kids than other types?
It is different in some ways because we really have to think about the chemotherapy that can get into the brain, that can get past that what we call blood-brain barrier, the protection of the brain from chemotherapy. So it's another cancer that we often use radiation for in addition to chemotherapy, because radiation obviously can go anywhere and get past that barrier.
Now, in Austin is calling from Dallas. I got that a little bit mixed up. That's great. Let's see. Austin, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi there. What's your question?
My question is about localized radiation treatment, such as proton therapy, and I was wondering if Dallas or UT Southwestern was looking at getting a proton therapy center from a company such as IBA.
Great question.
So we are actually in the process of building a radiation center at UT Southwestern, a proton radiation center at UT Southwestern. So we do not have that yet, but are in the process. So for those who may not know what proton radiation is, so there's different ways of delivering radiation. Typically, radiation is given by something called photons, which are essentially like X-rays, like what you would receive if you got a chest X-ray, but at a much higher dose. The problem with X-rays is that they go all the way through your body, and so they cause side effects all the way on the way in and all the way on the way out to all the tissues that they hit. Proton radiation is different. It's using a giant accelerator, essentially, to accelerate protons, which are a part of an atom, very fast, and those protons then are delivered to the body. The benefit of them is that once they go into your body, they stop, and so they don't come out the other side. And so they, we think, will cause less side effects because they're not damaging the tissues on the way out of the body.
So there's sort of no exit wound,
They
stop
exactly.
at the cancer.
We can program them to stop at the cancer, and so they don't deliver that exit wound. They still can cause side effects because they still cause an entrance wound, but they don't cause an exit wound.
And there are some proton centers in Texas. I think there are two.
There's a proton center down in Houston, yes, that send patients to when we think proton radiation would be the best option for them.
And one that's in development here,
correct,
as well, and yours. So there will be more.
There will be more. They're absolutely growing.
And are they best though for specific types of cancers for kids and also?
So there are specific details of where the cancer is that makes one type of radiation better or worse. Because of the way protons are given, they can cause more side effects for some patients. But so it really depends on where the cancer is in your body, what type of radiation is best. And so we work closely with other doctors, radiation oncologists, who are experts in that. And beyond protons, there's even other types of radiation being developed, like carbon radiation, where we actually accelerate even bigger molecules of carbon into the body, which may be able to reduce also the entrance wound to some extent.
Now, from what I've heard, proton therapy centers and the equipment used in them, if you're using an accelerator and so on, is pretty expensive.
They're very expensive to build, and the treatment is also more expensive than standard radiation.
Is it something for proton therapy that most insurance companies cover, or is it right now something you're out on your own?
Most of our patients, when we refer them for proton radiation, are able to get insurance coverage because insurance recognizes the benefit of this therapy in terms of reducing the long-term side effects of the treatment.
And how long has proton therapy been around?
So it's been developing for a while, but really only in the mainstream for the last 5 to 10 years.
So, good, a little bit, but
a
not
little bit, but not,
not,
not yeah. a very long time.
Now, Brent is calling from Burleson. Let's see. Brent, are you there?
Hello.
Hi. Hi, Ben.
Yeah, I'm here. I wanted to say, first of all, thank you and shout out to cancer researchers. As a near 14-year survivor, I'm a benefit of some of that research. I won't go into the long history, just I want to say thank you. And here's my question. Based on the current research and the success so far, do you see that this kind of immunotherapy kind of treatment may soon move into the frontline defense for treatment as opposed to being the last resort that it necessarily is right now? I'll go ahead and take my answer off there.
Great. Thanks. Thank you. What do you say?
I do think so. I think for a while, cancer therapy is going to be still a combination of all these methods that we've been talking about, chemotherapy and radiation, along with immunotherapy and along with targeted therapies, because I don't know. One of the things we've learned from cancer over the last 50 years is that it's very tricky to treat cancer, that cancer evolves resistance to many of our therapies, and that treating with only one therapy has not been successful. And so we've needed to combine different chemotherapy agents together or combine different modalities like chemotherapy and radiation. I do think that absolutely our goal is to move these treatments earlier into the treatment of patients so that they don't have to suffer all the long-term side effects of the other treatment, and so that we may be able to cure patients the first time and not allow them to relapse.
It's really become more of a mix of treatments, and there has been no cancer pill, I guess, as we once thought there might be.
Exactly. I think in the 1970s, when cancer, sort of the war on cancer began, people had hoped there would be a single pill that would cure everyone's cancer. And we've learned over time that there's all these different types of cancer. And then within each type, there's different genes that make the mutation. So it's very complicated, but I think we're making a lot of progress.
We're talking today with Dr. Ted Leitch. He's an assistant professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center, researching new therapeutics for childhood cancer. Join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from Ted Leitch after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest is Dr. Ted Leitch. He's an assistant professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center, researching novel therapeutics for childhood cancer. So we saw pretty impressive survival gains for kids with cancer from 1975 to 1995. Why do you think it is that survival rates haven't changed very much in the past few decades?
So I think between 75 and 95, we were really learning how to give combination chemotherapy, so how to give multiple drugs that target your cancer at the same time. And that's really what made those gains between those years. And I think now that we've reached the limit of what we can do with those combination chemotherapy, where we are giving doses that are so high that patients are having these side effects or getting sick from low blood counts or other things. And so we haven't been able to sort of continue those gains without new drugs. And so our hope is that now using targeted therapy and immunotherapy, we're going to be able to resume that progress.
Now, as a medical student, this makes me wonder. Not only do you have to learn about chemotherapy and radiation, but you also have to learn about immunotherapy and targeted therapies and genetic sequencing. How do you possibly cram all of this in?
Well, I think medicine has become more and more of an open book exam, right? So that no doctor is able to learn everything about every gene that can cause cancer. And so we work together in big teams. We have teams of doctors that work together, some of which are experts on the genetics and some of which are experts on targeted therapy and some of which are experts on immunotherapy. And then we all work together to try to derive the best treatment for each patient.
Yeah, it has to be much more of a collaboration. Terry in Dallas is calling. Let's see if Terry is there.
I want to ask a doctor a question about possible either intercession or prevention. By that I mean, when a baby is conceived, I mean, is it possible to chemically find out if there are cancer cells in the baby, although there are, but whether they will be threatening? And I don't know where medicine is on prevention and intercession. Maybe the doctor could explain something about it.
Okay,
I'll take my answer off the air.
Can we look at whether people are likely perhaps to develop cancer after they're born? Is that something you can look for in their blood?
Right. So we don't think most people are born with cancer. We think cancer is something that develops as you grow. We do think that these mutations that cause cancer in a cell start many months or years before you actually get cancer. And so there are probably some babies. We know there are some babies who are born with mutations that may lead them to have cancer in the future. The thing we haven't been able to work out very well yet is why some of those babies will go on to get cancers and others will not. And so we haven't yet really been able to figure out how to treat that in a different way. You know, our efforts of prevention are very important, things like stopping smoking and mammography and those kind of things. But we haven't yet figured out how to identify those mutations in people before they actually get cancer and target them.
Well, one of the things that's been in the news because of Angelina Jolie, some people might be familiar with, is certain genetics that make women more more likely to develop breast cancer or later on in life. Where is that in terms of, like you're saying, you can identify the mutation, but from there?
So I do think there are some cancers like breast cancer for women who have a BRCA mutation.
Yes.
That's the mutation that Angelina Jolie has, that we can implement screening programs for or do things like she decided to do where you have a prophylactic surgery to remove the tissue that may be at risk. And there are a few examples of that. Mainly those BRCA mutations, something called the P53 mutation, a few other mutations that may cause colon cancer and lead to screening. And so those things we try to identify for patients that have a family history that suggests they may be at risk. And then we can use the same genetic sequencing technology that I've been talking about to identify patients who do or do not have those mutations and offer them screening.
Hmm. Now, Tony in Fort Worth asks whether UT Southwestern is working with nanoparticles as delivery vehicles for chemo to targeted tissue or tumor areas. I'm not sure exactly what that would mean. Do you know what he's referring to?
Yes. So nanoparticles are actually one of the ways that we're looking at to try to target the tumor specifically with the chemotherapy. So nanoparticles are very, very small, essentially balls that hold chemotherapy in the center. And you give them through the blood. They circulate in the blood. The shell of the ball protects the body from the chemotherapy until it's released.
Mm.
And so
Like
a little bomb, essentially, that goes off. And our hope is we can develop nanoparticles that specifically target to the tumor, releasing the bomb of chemotherapy specifically where there are tumor cells. And so we're looking at that in patients, pediatric patients with sarcomas, where we're trying to develop bombs that explode when they're heated. And so we're trying to take these bombs and test them in patients and in preclinical studies in the laboratory to try to see whether or not they may be able to improve the response of the cancer to the chemotherapy while also decreasing the side effects of the chemotherapy on the rest of your body.
Very interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the cost of cancer care for a minute. The medical costs really linger long after some of these treatments are over and maybe even after side effects are gone. What does paying for breakthrough technologies like immunotherapy cost today?
So many of the new cancer drugs that have been approved are very expensive, upwards of $100,000 per patient for treatment. And so it can be very, very expensive to receive cancer care.
And is that cost, I guess, just like any other treatment, expected to go down? How long does it take for it to go down?
We don't really know yet. So this cost has gone up a lot as drug companies have developed these targeted inhibitors and immunotherapies, these new drugs over the last few years. Traditionally, those costs do go down when the patent expires on that medication, but that's 20 years later.
Mm.
And so we don't really know yet what the cost is going to do for the next next while.
And that many parents and people and families are going into debt, from what I hear, for trying to pay for treatment. So what option do you have to say no to it?
Right. It can be very difficult. Like you said, it's not something that you can really say no to, because it's the medicine that may save your child's life or may save your life, but it is very expensive. I think this is something that needs to be addressed on a systems level, that there is a very high cost of these drugs. Part of that is because there's a lot of research that's necessary to develop these drugs, and so those costs have to be recuperated. But part of that is also making it very difficult for families to afford the treatment.
Now, if you get in on a research, on a clinical trial, I'm assuming it's paid for.
Right. So generally on clinical trials, the drugs are provided for free.
But there are other risks with being in a trial that you don't really know, I guess.
So clinical trials are the way we've made all this progress that we have in cancer. And the many, many pediatric patients in particular, but other adult patients as well with cancer, are enrolled on clinical trials. And what we do in clinical trials is try to take the best therapy that we already know for someone's cancer and make it better. So we add a new drug if we think it may make it more efficacious, or we actually take something away if we're worried that there are too many side effects of the current best treatment. So there are certainly risks of that, because we don't know yet all the side effects of the new treatment, but that's also how we've gotten where we are.
You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. Now, it seems as if a lot of people are betting on immunotherapy right now. I saw there's even a stock index for it that's doing pretty well. Is this a bubble? I mean, are people too excited about this?
I think the history of cancer treatment shows us that nothing is ever as simple as we think it is at first glance. That being said, I do think there are many examples in the last few years of immunotherapy achieving results that have never been achieved before. As I mentioned, with patients with melanoma, and the results I was discussing for patients with the T-cell therapy for leukemia. So I do think it's very, very promising. It's never going to be as simple as we hope it to be, but I think it's definitely a promising therapy.
It's always interesting to see where the money goes behind new drugs, and
yes,
see which direction people are putting their faith in, and that definitely seems to be one of them. So, and as you said, there have been different waves of ideas about cancer therapies. What have people believed in that has failed?
Well, I think the very first cancer therapy was surgery, And so patients used to get bigger and bigger and bigger surgeries to try to cut out their tumor. And the surgeons thought that if they would just cut out more of the patient, that they could get all the metastases out and cure patients. And that actually hasn't proven to be the case.
We've seen some pretty horrific photos of that from the Emperor of All Maladies honing in on something they called the radical mastectomy.
Exactly. So surgeons used to take large portions of women's breast and their whole chest wall to try to get out their breast cancer. And it turns out, when someone actually did a study, that that's no better than taking out just the tumor in many cases. And so that was a wave that didn't really work. And then the next wave was single-agent chemotherapy. So doctors would give one medicine to try to treat the tumor, and then when that didn't work, they might give another medicine, but they'd give one at a time. And we learned over time that while that may induce a transient response, it doesn't cure patients, and that you have to give medicines, combine chemotherapy, multiple medicines at the same time or in a schedule to make patients better.
Which is now it's this mixture, it's this concoction.
Right. So this is what patients with cancer will receive, is more than one chemotherapy agent tailored to their specific cancer, given on a schedule over many months to years.
How many chemotherapy drugs are there right now? Are we talking dozens, hundreds, thousands?
There's dozens of chemotherapy drugs that we use commonly.
So it's actually not as big of a number as I might imagine.
Not as big as you might imagine, but there's lots of different combinations that we use. So, you know, three of the drugs given together, for example.
And when someone relapses, might you approach it with a different drug or just a different combination?
So we certainly can try that. One of the things we've learned is that cancer cells, when they're even given one or two chemotherapy agents, can develop what we call resistance to other chemotherapy agents. So they can, just because they've been treated with three doesn't mean they're going to be sensitive to a different three the next time you try. They actually can develop more global resistance. And so this is the reason why we've actually learned that it's not a good idea to give one medicine followed by another, because the cancer cells have become resistant to those subsequent medicines at the beginning. So sometimes we can treat patients and cure patients who's relapsed with more chemotherapy, but that's a rare situation.
Yeah, and once you go on and someone has relapsed two or three times, do you ever have the situation where you sort of run out of chemotherapy drugs?
We definitely have the situation where we run out of chemotherapy drugs that we know are efficacious. Many times those patients will be offered a clinical trial of a new drug that we haven't yet learned about whether or not it's effective for their cancer, some of those new targeted drugs or new immunotherapy drugs. And so that's the situation when we test those drugs for the first time, because we don't really know their effect. And then, as I mentioned, we try to move them up so that they actually can be used at the beginning, so we can cure patients the first time they get their cancer and not wait for it to come back.
So where do you see, or how do you imagine cancer treatment for kids looking in 5 years, or maybe 10 if that's not far enough out for you?
So I think that we're going to learn better how to incorporate all these therapies together. I don't think we're going to be in 5 or 10 years at a place where we can eliminate chemotherapy or eliminate radiation as treatment options. But I think we're going to be smarter about which chemotherapy agents we give, and smarter about how we give radiation, using things like protons to more specifically target the tumor. But then also combine that with specific inhibitors of the genes that are turned on in their cancer to try to turn those off and allow lower doses of chemotherapy to be effective.
So it's really going to require also a more team-based approach if you're going to have all these different areas you're trying to target.
Right, absolutely. Cancer treatment has become a team sport, right? So we all work together to take care of the best, give the best care.
How many doctors are with one patient? I mean, it used to be you had one doctor, right? When you're being treated for leukemia now, you have a team.
So you do have a team, and you have an even bigger team than sometimes patients realize. So we meet as a team with the surgeons and the radiation doctors and the oncologists, the whole team of oncologists and pharmacists and other groups every week to discuss our patients and discuss what the best treatment is. So patients may see two or three doctors, but they actually have a whole team of doctors thinking about their case to try to find the best treatment.
That's a pretty comforting thought, though. That's nice. That's nice to know. It's not just in one person's hands. Our guest today was Dr. Ted Leitch. He's an assistant professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center, researching novel therapeutics for childhood cancer. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can get in contact with us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Lauren Silverman. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.